This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U Mobile.
On the grill this morning, we welcome Richard Toll back to the grill. He is, of course, the local representative for the Malaysian chapter of the UNHCR, which is obviously the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which safeguard the rights and well-being of refugees and asylum seekers worldwide. Last time you came here, Richard, you spoke to Sharad Kutin. Now, before we begin, I want to ask anyone out there who wants to ask Mr. Toll or Richard, between friends, of course, if you have any questions, please WhatsApp them to us at 018 789-8899, that's 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, of course, Richard, welcome back. It is the World Refugee Day. It is obviously a cause for solidarity and celebration. Give us a quick rundown of where we sit in terms of the refugee influx in Malaysia at this point in time.
Well, there's no major influx of refugees in Malaysia at the moment. There's 160,000 registered with UNHCR and probably another 20,000 largely Rohingya who we haven't yet been able to find. So the numbers by global standards are still pretty modest.
Yeah, it's bizarrely though, Malaysia has never signed up to the 1951 Convention of Refugees, and that makes it quite anomalous because if we're not a signatory, then why are we doing our bit for the global refugee situation?
Well, the thing is, you don't have to sign the Refugee Convention to do the right thing for refugees. Looking after refugees is a humanitarian act, and signing the convention is a good statement, but there's a lot of countries around the world that have signed the convention that don't do nearly as much for refugees as countries like Malaysia does. It hasn't signed the convention, so it's not the be-all, end-all.
Yeah, which is interesting because when I looked at your website, 86% of the global refugees are being placed in developing countries, the developing world. It appears that the rich countries don't really want refugees in their midst. And I want to cite Singapore, right, versus Malaysia's 160,000 or 180,000, we count the unregistered ones. They don't have many refugees down there, do they? And why is that? Why is there a distinction?
Well, they've got a very tough border and policy in relation to migrants generally.
Are you suggesting that they might not be as humanitarian or sympathetic to refugees as Malaysia is?
Well, I don't think it's a relative game, but clearly they've got a very large landmass to their north, being Malaysia as a place where people can get to. So in a way, Singapore is given a shadow of protection from refugees by Malaysia and Thailand, because most of the big movements of refugees of the last 50 years have been from Vietnam, Cambodia, and more recently from Myanmar. And of course, as you just said, refugees tend to stop in places that they can get to first.
Yeah,
and that's why the burden is on the responsibility that lies really on the developing world. Unfortunately, because the global north, if I can use that, are putting more and more barriers and walls up, and the huge burden that rests on the shoulders of countries that can least afford to do it, but which tend to be more generous than others.
So there's a lot of moving parts here, Richard, obviously because I'm a big proponent of obviously the immigration workforce, and we look at it 200-300 years ago, America, the land of the free and the brave, the Statue of Liberty to give us your poor and your hungry and your displaced, and look at what this has become over 200 years of basically immigrant labor, and wanting to make a fist of it in a new universe, right? Are we in a position to embrace the blood, sweat and tears potentially of an immigrant workforce, or are we not? Where do you sit on this equation?
Well, countries around the world have always valued and benefited from migration and labour. Most of the countries of the South, if you the United States, Australia, New Zealand, have all benefited hugely from migration. 200 or 300 years ago, there were no sovereign boundaries across many of the states. There were small princeling states and fiefdoms in various parts of the world. So there were no passports. And of course, labor was moved in huge numbers to enrich colonies and empires. And we're still living with many of the legacies of those days.
Well, no further than you're from New Zealand, Richard, but to the Australians, I guess, for want of a better word, they were populated initially by convicts from the UK, 200 years ago, so and look at where Australia is now.
Well, New Zealanders don't comment much on convict populations from Australia, but on the refugee issue, I think what's the important point is that countries like Malaysia have more than done their fair share over the last 50 years.
Yep.
And countries which have greater GDP, greater privilege, have put up the boundaries to make it difficult for people to get there. So that's why we need a new way of looking at this. We need a global compact that's built around solidarity, solidarity for refugees, but also solidarity for the countries that are really doing their best. The greatest number of refugees today are in Turkey, which hosts 3.5 million, and in Lebanon, where one in five people is a refugee. So the populations of refugees are really putting a strain and stress on ordinary, well-meaning and generous countries.
And yet, when you look at it, it does seem as if, at least from a layperson's perspective, that there are equally strong arguments for and against taking the refugee influx, because obviously land limitations might be one issue, resource limitations, healthcare limitations, employment limitations might be one as well. But then, of course, you've also got the other side where this is basically a potential workforce and a labor force which can be deployed instantaneously, right? I mean, no refugee wants to be displaced from his or her home country. And they want to get work immediately and feel useful, right? So where are the pressure points where Malaysia is concerned but in terms of the 160,000 registered refugees?
The problem for refugees in Malaysia is that they've always been treated as illegal migrants. So they have no lawful right to be here. They have no legal right to work. So the question really is, how do they look after themselves? How do they be self-sufficient if they've got no form of legal income? And the answer is that they fall down into the black market economy, where they're exploited, they're not paid good wages, and they live in doing the work of the 3 Ds, the difficult, dangerous, and dirty work that nobody else wants to do.
So the UNHCR Malaysia has had regular dialogues with the foreign ministry as well as with the home ministry. Now, of course, things are in a bit of a state of flux because we don't have ministers appointed to those positions yet. But where is the dialogue on that particular issue? Because obviously, in terms of getting gainful employment for refugees, it's not a clear-cut issue.
It hasn't been a clear-cut issue. With the previous government, we were making some quite good headway. They'd agreed to a pilot project for Rohingya, and they were looking at a new registration scheme for refugees, which we hope will now be continued with the new government. The manifesto of the new government is very promising. They've said that refugees will be allowed to live here legally. Their UNHCR ID cards will be recognized, and they'll be allowed to work. We think letting refugees work is an absolutely critical step forward, because if they're working legally, they're not going to be in the black market economy. So they're not going to be around criminality. So you flush them out of the black market economy, it's good for law and order. If you flush them out of the black market economy, it's good for the economy itself. And they're not taking jobs away from Malaysians. And actually, there's good evidence to suggest that they increase the value chain for Malaysian jobs at higher income levels. And lastly, it's good for refugees, because if they've got lawful, decent income, they can have better health care and better education and not be at all dependent on the hospitality of Malaysians.
Absolutely.
So it's a win-win all round.
Nobody wants to be nobody wants to fall on the wrong side of the law. No, nobody wants to not feel useful. But where are the conditionalities when it comes to refugee employment in Malaysia? What are the where are the boundaries? Where are the conditions on this, Richard?
Well, at the moment, they're not allowed to work, so there's no conditions around at all. If they're caught working under the law of Malaysia as it stands, they can be arrested and charged and put in detention.
But where's the dialogue going? You're saying that there's more accommodative compact going on. Where's the dialogue going?
Well, the dialogue now with the new government's manifesto is to try and find a scheme where they can be legalised and to work lawfully, and that's the key. We think it can be done quite easily. You don't have to sign the Refugee Convention to do that. You can tweak some of your domestic regulations and executive orders, and it can be done.
We are talking this morning to Richard Toll, the representative for UNHCR Malaysia, which is obviously the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which safeguards the rights and well-being of refugees and asylum seekers worldwide. Today, of course, is World Refugee Day. We're going to be coming back, Richard, and getting more of your thoughts in terms of other pressing matters for refugees, healthcare, social security, well, even security, things like that. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
On the grill this morning, we have Richard Toll, the representative for UNHCR Malaysia, which is, of course, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which safeguards the rights and well-being of refugees and asylum seekers worldwide. Today, of course, is World Refugee Day, Richard. Now, obviously, employment is one issue. Feeling useful in the workplace is one issue. But also, there's also things like healthcare, right? 160,000 refugees, 180,000 registered and unregistered and refugees, where do they go for healthcare? What is the solution there?
Well, if you need primary healthcare, local clinics, we've negotiated with a fantastic local healthcare provider, Qualitas, and there's 140 clinics around Malaysia where refugees can show up with ID and they can get a discounted off the commercial rate for primary medical care, including drugs and support. If you need something more serious like hospital care, we've negotiated with one of the big banks here, a private healthcare insurance, so for refugees only, and that will provide a very significant level of cover for people who need to have the misfortune of falling into the healthcare in hospitals.
Who pays for healthcare? Who pays Qualitas, Richard? I mean, I saw in the paper some years ago, I think you mentioned $8 million, or was it $12 million was your allocation to take care of 160,000 refugees in Malaysia. That's not a lot of money.
That's not much money at all. It's really trying to find a commercial basis for looking after healthcare of refugees.
Is there a commercial basis for that? How do you work it out?
If refugees can work legally, they'll have more disposable income. And the arrangements we have with Qualitas is an extremely generous and modest one for costs. Refugees for about 40 ringgit can get a consultation and can get some whatever drugs and medications that they need. That's a competitive rate, and using a private health provider for hospital care, there can be a commercial basis for that, but also provide a good basis for hospital care at no cost to the Malaysian taxpayer.
Okay, so let's break it down a little bit, Richard. Explode some myths for us, right? The presumption, rightly or wrongly, is that refugees are by and large unskilled, unqualified, and only deserving of dirty, dangerous jobs. Is that true? Or are we talking about potentially skilled workers, potentially beneficiaries of this to the system?
Well, it depends on where you're looking. If you look at the history of migration and refugees going to the United States, it's full of rocket scientists. Einstein was a refugee. So the fact that you're a refugee doesn't mean you come from an unskilled employment base. Many people who come here from the Middle East have postgraduates and doctorates in sciences, and all they want to do is be given a chance to work and give back something to the country that's offering them hospitality.
Well, break it down for us further, Richard. I mean, 160,000 registered refugees, the vast majority of which are Rohingyas from Myanmar, Burma, right? What kind of backgrounds, what kind of benefits to the system can they bring?
Well, it's true that Rohingya don't appear.
By and large, they don't.
They're not highly skilled, but they work very, very well in the construction industry, for example, at minimal cost.
Which is the thing about Triple D as well, because at the same time, from a human rights perspective, you don't want them to be, suffering, accidents, workplace accidents, do you?
I think that's why it's important to regularize the workforce for refugees. If they're working in the construction industry, that doesn't mean they have to be treated poorly. They should be able to get a competitive salary according to the market. They work well in that sector. It's a sector that's not competitive with Malaysians. And if you look around the skyscrapers of this fine city of Kuala Lumpur, you'll see that the sweat of refugees and migrant labourers have really created this economic miracle that you live in today. So let's not underestimate the very significant contribution that migrants and refugees have made to the economy.
I'm talking this morning to Richard Toll, the representative for UNHCR Malaysia, which is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, on the grill. Now, again, a little bit of a contradictory movement within the new Pakatan government, because one of the central tenets of the manifesto was a 1,500 ringgit minimum wage. Now, if you've got a minimum wage in place at 1,500 ringgit, there's no way possible that a Rohingya refugee is going to get a job in any construction site, because no construction company is going to be willing to pay them 1,500 ringgit a month. So that obviates any notion of any paid employment at all, unless there's some kind of contract worker structure framework.
Well, I think if you look at the real salary incomes of people in the construction industry, many of them are probably working and earning more than 1,500 ringgit a month. So it's a fairly basic salary or basic income floor. But many people are around that level or a little bit higher. A lot of refugees currently in the illegal labor market economy are working with that sort of an income.
Okay, let's move on to other things like sanitation and, of course, accommodation, right? When I look in your website, the vast majority of refugees are being placed in Selangor, in this order, Selangor, Kuala Lumpur, and then Penang, right? Penang's got about 10,000, 15,000. Selangor's got about 60,000, 70,000. Where are these refugees being placed? Are they in habitable conditions? Are they in, you know, livable human conditions?
Well, I think the first thing is they're not placed by anybody other than self-selection. They arrive, they're illegal under the law, so they tend to follow where the work is or where their communities are. So many of the refugee communities that are working in the construction tend to be down there in JB, on the east coast, and as you say, around Selangor and around Kuala Lumpur, around the Klang Valley. So you will find congregations of refugees where the work tends to be. There are no refugee camps here, unlike previous days of the Vietnamese boat people of 40 or 30 years ago. They tend to live in the lower income areas of town, in apartments crammed in with others. And of course, that does lead to levels of sanitation problems, health problems, dengue and malarial issues. So there are a lot of health issues around the bottom end of the socioeconomic pool.
So lots of things to do in terms of refugee care in Malaysia. You know, where are most of your resources deployed, Richard? And, you know, what are the top two or three pressing issues that occupy your time?
Well, here in Malaysia, I think the top pressing issue today is to see if we can take that manifesto statement from the new government and put it into practice. If we can get refugees to live here lawfully, and if they can earn a reasonable income, then that will emancipate them from the impoverishment that they currently face and reduce the burden that Malaysia currently faces in looking after them. So it's a win-win all round, and we think that's quite doable.
What about in terms of the workplace itself? There could be some social stigmas attached to hiring Rohingyas or hiring refugees. You know, one assumption could be that employers are not keen to hire refugees, documented or otherwise, because of the stigma it might bring. I mean, if you're running a fancy artisan coffee place, you don't want to be, you know, burdened with that particular stigma. So is there a social element to all this?
I think you'd be surprised. If you, next time you have your latte down in the local coffee shop or have your nasi lemak, you ask where that fellow is from, and he'll probably tell you he's from Myanmar. He may well have a UNHCR card. They are with you, living and working for you in every part of the country and the economy. And that's the contradiction in Malaysia, that illegal and unregulated migrant labor have created enormous possibilities and created, in a sense, a sort of socioeconomic addiction to the benefits of cheap labor. It would not take much to allow refugees to live here lawfully, and it wouldn't take anything away from the protection and safety of the Malaysian hosting community.
And of course, part of your work is also, I mean, nobody wants to leave his or her home country for a foreign land, least of all one which doesn't welcome them. So part of your job also entails putting them back in their home countries, right? As you say, the vast majority of refugees in this country are from Burma. What's your read of the situation there? Are conditions over there amenable to their return in the imminent future or not?
Well, it's really a bit of a mixed story. We've got currently terrible issues for the Rohingya who have been displaced in their hundreds of thousands, principally to Bangladesh, but also a fairly large population here. The prognosis for early return for them is pretty gloomy, so we need to make sure that they're looked after well as best we can in countries of asylum like Malaysia and Bangladesh. But on the other hand, for some of the other ethnic groups like the Chin and Hmong and Karen and one or two other ethnic groups that have been in Thailand and Malaysia for many years, the prognosis is different, and we are now starting to see the possibility for those people to think about going home. So there's light at the end of the tunnel for some of the groups. It's not only a gloomy story.
Okay, interesting question I've got, Richard, from a chap named Koo SK, same surname as myself. He's asking me to ask you to check whether you can push for equal education rights for refugees, for refugee children. Now, this is an interesting concept as well, because obviously it's not just the parents who want to work. It's also the children who need to go to school.
Well, that's a good question. We currently support about 125 learning centres in Malaysia where refugee kids go to school, but that's all in the parallel universe. It's not part of the mainstream school system at all. What we would like to see is opportunities for those private schools to be accredited so that the qualifications at those schools can be recognised by the Malaysian system itself.
Yeah, some of these peripheral schools, if you can call them that, I saw some articles on the internet. I think the word living hell, the term living hell was used. You know, teachers don't turn up, they go there, and obviously your facilities and your resources are very thin at best. Obviously, you've got a whole, dialogue to conduct with the Home Ministry and the Foreign Ministry, Richard. How are you structuring this discussion with them? How are you going to make it happen for refugees?
Well, as I said, the first point is really to have a better legal and policy framework for dealing with refugees.
Which laws in particular would you want to see reviewed?
At the moment, there are no laws at all in relation to refugees. So they are treated under the Malaysian laws and have been for many, many years. They're treated as illegal migrants. So we think that the first point would be, starting point is to have a comprehensive policy that deals with refugees. Who are they? What rights do they have? What's expected of them? They have to obey Malaysian law, clearly. They should have forms of identity documentation that carry biometric data so that we know who's here and that they're not getting into any kinds of trouble. And off the back of that, then you can build rights and access to the workforce, opportunities for education, and opportunities for better healthcare.
How far away are we from that? Because, I mean, from what I can gather, the kind of legislation that applies to refugees in the past has been SOSMA and POTA, right, which is the Prevention of Terrorism Act, and the Emergency Ordinance Matters, right, which is obviously exactly the opposite of what you want achieved. How far away are we from an accommodative legal framework?
I don't think we need to be too far away. You can take some fairly minor steps. We can regularize refugees quite easily, give them the right to work without any major legislative changes. So those things are achievable on the short term, and they would make a huge difference for the life of refugees, and we think bring back dividends to a country that's always going to be concerned about security and terrorism and who's coming across borders. The best way to deal with border security today is to register people who are coming across the borders and find out who's here, not bury one's head in the sand and pretend that there isn't an illegal migration problem at all.
Lots of work to do for the new government then. But in terms of resources, and even yourself, Richard, you're a lawyer in New Zealand. You've come over and you've basically entered a job which is by and large thankless and hugely draining of your mental capabilities. Well, what drives you to do what you do, and what drives people to join you in terms of a volunteer workforce?
I've been doing this work for 25 years, and I have to say it's been an absolute privilege to work with wonderful people. Refugees are not victims. They are resilient people like you and I who've suffered terrible circumstances in their lives. And what marks them is their ability to overcome those terrible challenges and obstacles and to emerge with dignity and hospitality. You'll find in refugee communities around Malaysia and here in the Klang Valley a far greater degree of hospitality than you find in other communities.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that people see when they travel the world, especially in developing countries, is the friendliness and openness of people that you least expect. It's not just Rohingyas as well. We've also got Pakistanis, you've got Syrians as well. We're holding at least 20 different nationalities in Malaysia. By and large, I mean, what do they want most of all, Richard, when they talk to you? What do they want most of all? Top two things.
First top thing is refugees want to go home.
They want to go home,
they're
right?
Not, yeah. They're not migrants. They haven't chosen to come here for work or for family unity purposes. They've come because they had to get out of where they were because of hell on earth. And what we have to do is create conditions where things are safer and better for them to go home. That's what you would want. It's what I would want. It's what refugees want. And this is, on World Refugee Day, a chance to express our humanitarian solidarity for those fine people.
Richard, it was an absolute privilege and a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for spending time and your thoughts with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much, Chung.
We're talking to Richard Toll, the representative for UNHCR Malaysia, which is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, seeking to safeguard the rights and well-being of refugees and asylum seekers worldwide. That was The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile. Your passion drives our unlimited ideas.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.